Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, between natural disasters like Hurricane Sandy and man-made inflictions like broken homes, economic struggles, more Americans become displaced every day. Journalist Sally Ooms joins me at the end of today's show. She talked with many who'd been forced from what they call home and tried to define what real home means. That's coming up around 12:40. My second guest is a return visitor, best-selling thriller author Steve Berry. His new book has a fascinating spin on what many believe is a true story involving Henry VIII's daughter, Queen Elizabeth I, good Queen Bess. His story is set in contemporary times, but there's this spin of history in there. Those of you who are Steve Berry fans know that he's a history buff and weaves that into all of his books. I've never heard about this story that he shares, but you are going to have to stay tuned to find out what that's all about. It's very fascinating. First, we are joined by the sexy vegan, a.k.a. Brian Patton. He's the author of the Sexy Vegan Cookbook and the Sexy Vegan's Happy Hour at Home. He's been featured in the New York Times, Huffington Post, and countless vegan publications. He's also the executive chef for Veggin Out, LA's premier vegan meal delivery service. Brian Patton, welcome.
Ah, thank you very much, Vicki. Thank you for having me.
So I was told by your publicist it's okay just to, I have to refer to you as his sexiness.
His sexiness is the preferred addressing of myself, yes.
So you are described as the quintessential regular dude vegan chef. And I read that you began posting instructional cooking videos on YouTube.
Right.
Yep. And you created this alter ego. Tell us how that began for you.
You know, I had only been vegan for a short time. And you know, this was back in like 2006-ish, maybe 2007. And a friend of mine was telling me about this YouTube.com that I had never heard of. After he got done explaining to me what it was, I was like, wait, you can do what? Like, this was, like, mind-blowing to me. So I thought, you know, I'm just getting into this vegan cooking thing. Maybe I'll do, like, a little cooking, instructional cooking video, just basically to entertain my friends and family. I'm on the West Coast. Everybody else is on the East Coast. So I thought this was a good way to sort of keep in touch. So I was like, I'll make, like, a spoof of a cooking show that would be on the Food Network, and I'll use adult humor and language, and my friends will laugh, and everybody will have fun. But it really ended up sort of getting a following other than just my friends and family, and people started emailing me, say, hey, you know, why don't you make some more of these episodes? This was really good and funny and whatever. So I started making more episodes, and, you know, it just grew and grew, and, you know, I got all the social media things, you know, Facebook. I had a MySpace page one time, may it rest in peace, and, you know, I just slowly grew a following, and then eventually I got contacted by New World Library Publishing, and they said, hey, we saw your videos, you want to make a book? And I said, okay.
Well, those are the kind of success stories we just love to share.
Yes, I love them as well, especially when they happen to me.
Yeah, and that was your first book. What was that called?
The Sexy Vegan's Cookbook, Extraordinary Food from an Ordinary Dude.
Right. And then, so you continued doing your video blogging, and your editor contacted you again, I guess, and said, what's going on?
Right. Well, they enjoyed the first book, and it sold well, and I guess at least good enough that they wanted a second book. So they said, hey, do you want to do another book? Do you have any ideas for a new book? And I said, of course I do. And then I had to go and make up a bunch of ideas because I actually did not have any at the time. So, you know, I came up with a few that they didn't like so much, like Pie Hard, my all pies vegan cookbook, or Toast Busters, which would have been all toast. And they really didn't like the... the all-Indian cookbook, Sexy 2 Electric Vindaloo, although I think that would have been a great book.
There you go.
So I had this, been doing this thing at my house that I was doing. This is a little, every Friday night I just do this little happy hour, sort of small plates, tapas type thing, just for me and my wife. And we just sit out on the balcony and, you know, have some wine and, you know, have these little plates that I would whip up. And it sort of became a thing where friends wanted to come over and enjoy with us our happy hour. So I just started doing it weekly. So then I said to the publisher, hey, I've been doing this happy hour thing at home. Maybe we could do a book, Happy Hour at Home. So they liked that idea better than my other stupid ideas. And here we are.
And obviously your girlfriend enjoyed this time, or your wife enjoyed this time, because she was right. Your girlfriend at the time.
She was my girlfriend? Yes, right. I think that was the happy hours that really solidified her into agreeing to become a fiancé and then a wife. So I really think it was a big part of the whole process, definitely.
Now, you haven't always been vegan. You describe yourself as a fat 12-year-old who just loved, could eat a whole stromboli to himself. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
so what,
I'd kill a pizza or a stromboli in like 2 seconds.
So what made you become a vegan?
Well, it was the health aspect of it. I was, you know, 27, 28 years old, and I just was in a bad way. I weighed about 260 pounds. I smoked cigarettes. I enjoyed the cocktail more than I should have. And I just was ready for a change. So I had started working for the company where I'm executive chef now. It's called Veggin' Out. It's a vegan delivery service in Los Angeles. And I started working for them. I saw this food being prepared. I helped prepare this vegan food. It was just a new thing for me, like seeing that a whole meal can happen without, you know, any animal products. So I thought, okay, I'll try this for a month. Maybe it'll get me back to, like, sort of healthier eating, and then I'll go back to eating meat and dairy, but I'll just do it in a smarter way. But after a month, I lost a few pounds. I felt pretty good. I thought I could do another month. So then I just kept doing another month. 10 months later, I lost 60 pounds. I felt amazing, and I never really looked back.
Wow.
So that was how I became vegan. And then, you know, as in those first, you know, in those first 10 months or year, you also get exposed to the ethical aspect, factory farming. You figure out, you know, that you can survive and thrive without something else having to die. So that it all just sort of, you know, solidified my veganness.
Right, right. You share a couple of tips. You have a couple of tips for people who are vegan living in a non-vegan world, because being vegetarian is one thing, but when you go totally vegan, I would imagine it's more difficult.
Yes, I mean, you know, especially for going out to eat with friends, you know, you definitely always want to scope out the menu on, you know, just about every restaurant you can get, you know, the menu online. So you definitely want to check the menu online, and you sort of become this, like, menu ninja where you can just pick out the things on any menu, and you can say, okay, I can make that vegan. I could, you know, just by asking the server to make certain little changes. So, you know, going into, you know, while you're going out with friends, going out to eat, you definitely want to be prepared, you know, have in your head what you want to do, because you don't want to be, because that's the thing that's going to, like, draw attention to yourself and make yourself maybe a little uncomfortable with the people around you, you know, just if you're fumbling, trying to figure out what to eat and asking a lot of questions. If you have all that beforehand, you could go and you could say, okay, I'll have this, but could you leave the cheese off of that, and I'll have this, and can you make this with, you know, vegetable stock or whatever. So I think being prepared in those situations is really important, and just speak with confidence, I think, is another way to do it. And it's really great for people who are not vegan, who are sitting there and watching you, you know, build a vegan meal out of any menu that you might see at a restaurant, and it makes it not look so difficult, because maybe one of your friends is, you know, thinking, oh, maybe I'll try this vegan thing, but what about when I eat out? It's going to be hard. If you get really good at that, which you will, like, that's just another way to spread your message, I guess, to making it look like it is easy to operate in a vegan world You just have to sort of change your thinking and the way that you do things.
Yeah.
And it's really easy.
Yeah, and just be prepared, as you said.
So prepared, absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about this book. I have to share this with you, Brian. I had a couple of friends over Friday night, and my friend Rich picked up your book, which was on my cocktail table, and he goes...
Perfect place for this book, on a cocktail table.
There you go. Yes, I kept it handy, because I was going to mix some drinks from it.
I love it.
And he picks it up and he goes, the sexy vegan. He goes, isn't that an oxymoron?
Oh, that's so funny. Yes, I've definitely been victim to many barbs like that. But, yeah, that's funny.
I think it's
the opposite. I think, when you become vegan, your physical body changes in mm-hmm. a positive way. So that's sexy. And also, your mental state improves, I feel. Like, I felt that my mind was clearer and I was more confident in my thoughts after I made this change. So, that's sexy. Who's it? What's his name? I want to give that guy a call. Give me his number.
His name is Rich. You can go biff him. The pictures of the food are very sexy, I have to tell you. It looks delicious. I mean, you make vegan food look delicious, and that's really what it's all about. It's not what you're eating, it's is it good and tasty? And I made cocktails Friday night. I mixed the one with rum and ginger and ginger beer,
because
English, I always have a little stash of ginger beer in.
Tell
us about that, how you came up with these mixes. You tried them yourself, and then tell us how I bet you enjoyed that process, right?
That was one of the more fun processes of the book, for sure, is testing out the cocktails. So, most of the cocktails that are in this book, came from, I was working on the food part of the book, and then I was, okay, I'm using mango in this menu, so, maybe I could pair a drink with this menu. So I took some extra, for this one in particular, I took some of the extra mango that I had left over from whatever I was making. I pureed it, and I thought, okay, mango and rum, that will go great together. And then I wanted something fizzy, but I didn't want it to be just club soda. I wanted to have a little more flavor, and I had a ginger beer sitting in the fridge, so I just put that in, and it really literally came together like that. So it's just the mango puree and the ginger beer and the rum, and it's really simple and delicious and just... if you're having something that has, has mango in it or similar flavors or flavors that marry well with the mango, like other citruses, it's a great cocktail to have. And that's how a lot of the cocktails came to be, is that I used some of the food or fruit from a menu and made a cocktail out of it. And I just love ginger beer, so.
Oh, I do too. And that's not non-alcoholic for anybody who's not familiar with that. It's pop,
That's correct. It's actually brewed, which is why they call it a ginger beer or ginger brew. And that's what makes it different than, like, ginger ale, which is basically just, weakly flavored carbonated water and sweetened. But ginger beer is brewed with real ginger, and just the flavor is, like, amazing.
Yeah. So do you have a favorite recipe in this book? And many of them really do look delicious.
Thank you. Favorite recipe, I would have to say it is the stromboli. You mentioned stromboli before. And I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania, so it was a very, Italian-Irish area. And so there was lots of pizza places and strombolis and things around. But when I moved to Los Angeles, there was no stromboli. And stromboli is basically a calzone that's really big and is usually loaded with all kinds of different meats and cheeses and sausage and sauce and stuff. So I grew up eating this, and I wanted to veganize it. So I stuffed it with a bunch of great fresh vegetables, vegan cheese, tomato sauce, and it's basically, a stuffed tube of pizza, I guess. I don't know how to explain it, but but it's just something I grew up eating, and, I kind of ate one a day when I was in college, which kind of led to my 260-pound situation, but I just whipped up a healthier version of it now that everybody can enjoy.
Right. And, some people do turn their nose up at vegetarian food, let alone vegan food. But you have created dishes that I think would satisfy meat eaters. And you call them sliders, Little Macs.
Little Mac.
Yeah, and the intent, you say, is not to replicate the taste of meat. It's just to create something that's good and tasty.
Right. I mean, you know, like, I think that's a great dish. But basically, they are mini Big Macs. And when you think about a Big Mac, like, the flavor, it doesn't, like, whatever meat or, I don't even want to call it, whatever they use that they call patties, you know, they don't have much flavor anyway. It's all about the toppings on a Big Mac, especially.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you could whip up a special sauce, which I have done for you in the book, and then it's, you know, lettuce, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. And you know, when you're taking a bite, but the patties I made actually do have flavor, so you have some extra flavor in there that you wouldn't normally have, but you know, they're just great. Like, you take a bite, and it just triggers this thing in your mind. You feel like you are eating this flavor that you used to eat, you know, when you were a kid. And that's really the key to vegan cooking in general, especially if you're trying to recreate something. It's just using this context of flavors, because the meat doesn't really do a whole lot most of the time.
Right.
It's really the things you put with it that kind of trigger this thing in your brain that tells you you are eating it, when actually you're eating something that's much better for you.
Yeah. And you've included recipes from all over. You've broken it. Tell us a little bit about the book itself, because you've broken it down into segments like Little India,
right.
Little Britain.
Exactly. So instead of it being in chapters, it's in menus. So, and the menus, you know, each menu has 2 to 3 to 4 dishes, depending. And they're all, it's sort of themed. So we have one, I have one that's like little India. So I do like samosa pizzas, I do stuffed dates, I do a couple different chutneys, and some roasted chickpeas. So that would be like one themed sort of meal. So then I do like one that's called Little Britain, which is a bangers and mash hand roll. So I take, you know, the traditional bangers and mash with gravy, and I basically roll it in a piece of steamed cabbage. So you have this bangers and mash that's sort of handheld, which is great for happy hour. I try to have utensil usage to a minimum. So any edible utensils I can create from food are encouraged. So it's broken down. You know, I have an Italian menu. I have the Indian menu. I have a Korean menu. I have a Japanese menu. So they're all, I just use different flavors just so you can have different types of happy hours whenever you want. So you can tell your friends, oh, we're having our little Tokyo tonight. We're going to make, you know, unagi nigiri with portobello mushrooms and sautéed green beans and blackened edamame, and some nachitinis, which is an Asian pear martini. So
yeah, and yeah. So I literally could go have 20 weeks of Friday night happy hours at my home and do something different every week.
Absolutely, you could do something different every week, and there's also some great features in the book. Like at the beginning of each menu, there's an efficiency tip, so it'll actually tell you, you know, the best order in which to do things, since you'll be preparing several dishes at once. So it sort of takes, you know, skills that I use, you know, working in my professional kitchen, that I can impart to those at home so that they can work most efficiently. And then there's also a shopping list at the back of each menu that makes it really easy and is laid out, like produce is in one section, you know, pantry items and then miscellaneous stuff. So there's a really easy shopping list. Then there's QR codes that you can scan with a smartphone that will, for certain recipes, pop up a video on your smartphone or tablet that will further help you make the recipe. So it's just packed with tons of cool things that hopefully the reader will find value in, and I think so far they have.
Well, I think having the shopping list there is awesome, because that's, you know, inevitably I've gone out to make something and come back and I have one ingredient missing.
Absolutely.
So I think it's awesome.
I've done that. I just did that last week.
You've done that.
Yeah, everybody does it. Doesn't matter how long you've been doing it. But yeah, the shopping list in the book, it's all on one page. You don't have to go pick through, okay, I need, you know, you don't have to thumb through the pages because the different recipes are on different pages in the same chapter. Obviously, they're not all on the same page because they wouldn't fit. So having that shopping list just keeps it all in one spot, and, you know that you're not going to have to run back out to the store.
Right.
As we all have done.
Right. Now, I heard that you are having a child, or maybe you've had your baby now, your wife's had.
No, there is a child on the way. It has not come to the earth yet.
Hasn't cooked
October,
yet.
October 11th will be the due date.
Okay. And since your wife is vegan too, right?
She's pescatarian. She'll eat fish sometimes, really only when we go out, and, you know, she'll eat some cheese here and there. Mm-hmm. But at home, like, you know, it's all vegan. But when we go out, she'll have some sushi or something.
So is the baby going to be raised vegan? I mean, how does that work?
The baby will be raised vegan. And, you know, I'm just starting to sort of look into it now. And basically, like, you know, in the beginning anyway, babies are only, you know, after they're, you know, when they start getting solid foods, it's all just vegetables and fruits anyway. So that's already taken care of. And it just, you know, I don't see any need to introduce any animal products because I don't feel it's a thing that humans require. I think it's a detriment to humans. So, you know, I can only do what I can do, though. You know, at some point, this kid's going to be out in the world somewhere, and, you know, they'll be making their own decisions. So I don't want to be a tyrant about it because that might cause a rebellion, you know? it's all about education and you know, giving them the right information at the right times. Like, you know, I'm not going to show a one-year-old a slaughterhouse video, but I'm going to tell them that animals are their friends and take them to meet some cows and stuff, you know, so that they'll be able to make the connection between the food. Because that's a thing I did not have growing up, and most of us didn't have, is the connection. Like, you just see ground meat in the grocery store, you buy it, and you make a burger because you think that's all there is.
Right.
And you don't realize where that came from because it's so well shrouded in very excellent advertising by all the major animal product companies. So
yeah. Well, I certainly enjoyed the book, and I'm going to definitely have a few happy hours of my own based on the recipes here. Loved it. And a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I think just, you can get all the information you need about me at my website, thesexyvegan.com. And I'm on all of the various social media things. You can just find me, The Sexy Vegan, at whatever social media outlet you might think of. I'm there. So, I think just may all of your hours be happy.
I love it. Thank you, The Sexy Vegans.
Thank you, Vicky.
Happy hour at home, Brian Patton. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by best-selling author Steve Berry. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Yeah. When I walk on by, girls be looking like Debbie Fly. I pick to the beat, walking down the street in my new the freak, yeah. This is how I roll, animal print pants out of control. It's Red Bull with the big ass fro, and like Bruce Lee, I got the clout, yeah.
Girl, look at that body. Girl, look at that body. Girl, look at that body.
I work out.
Girl, look at that body. Girl, look at that body. Girl, look at that body.
I work out when I walk in the spot.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Going against the grain has never been so much fun. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
I'm sexy and I know it.
And welcome back, everyone. That's a nod to the sexy vegan there. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and I'm very pleased to have Steve Berry back with us. He's the New York Times and number one internationally best-selling author of 8 Cotton Malone adventures, 4 standalone thrillers, and 4 short story originals. His books have been translated into 40 languages with more than 15 million printed copies in 51 countries. And his new book is called The King's Deception. Steve Berry, welcome.
That's great to be back.
Well, you always write such fascinating stories because you do such a lot of research. Everybody knows that you're a history buff. And I read that you got the idea for this story, for The King's Deception, when you were visiting Ely Cathedral in England. So tell us how the germ of the idea came about for you.
Well, the lady who was showing us around, we were doing publicity work up there, sure. I always ask about mysteries or secrets in an area, and she said there really wasn't any around here, but there is something about an hour or so from here at a place called Bisley, and she told me about a legend where the local villagers for many centuries would take a young boy, dress him up in Elizabethan female, Elizabethan costume, and parade him through the streets. And that's very odd that you would do that for, you know, on a day certain for several hundred years. So I began to look into it and discovered that I wasn't the first writer to discover it. Bram Stoker, in the early part of the 20th century, likewise came across it and wrote about it in a book called Famous Imposters. It was a book he wrote. And as I studied more about it, I began to see that there was a great factual basis to the legend. And the legend is that Elizabeth, the young Princess Elizabeth at age 13, was living over there. She died at the age of 13, was buried there, and a young boy was substituted in her place. And that young boy eventually became the Queen of England.
So you obviously came up with the idea for this. Tell us how you integrated it into the book. And then I want to look a little bit more about the history, because I'd never heard this story before, and I just find it fascinating.
Yeah, it's a very interesting. It's a very I didn't make this story up. This is a true story that was from that region of England. It's called the Bisley Boy Legend, and it's there. And it really deals with Elizabeth, and this is how we integrated it in. You know, when I began to look at it, I discovered that, you know, all her life Elizabeth wore wigs. She wore heavy face paint. She wore clothes that didn't flatter her and covered up her body, basically. She never allowed doctors to examine her. When she died, there was no autopsy performed on her because she specifically forbade it and said that no one was to see her body after she was dead, and no one did. It was sealed away very immediately. Her number one job as a queen was to have an heir, and yet she refused to marry, refused to have a child, called herself the Virgin Queen. Then when she dies, they bury her in the same grave with Mary, her sister, so their bones will mingle together. And it says that on the tomb, wow. Their bones mingling together. Now, if that doesn't say that there's something fishy going on here,
yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty strong evidence that something's going on here.
Right. And so tell us, your book is set in contemporary times. Cotton Malone, of course, is your protagonist, and he gets into all kinds of trouble all the time. This time, he goes over to England to try and rescue his son. So tell us a little bit about the story.
Well, it's a father-son story, basically, because we're resolving this question of Cotton and his son. There's some problems between them, and they're going to resolve that in this story. And he's doing a favor for someone, and when he gets over there, you know, everything just kind of goes wrong, and he's caught up in this geopolitical battle for the next 30 hours. And it involves finding this historical secret because the United States wants to use it to blackmail England into doing something for them. You see, it really matters if Elizabeth was a fraud. It matters a whole lot, in fact, today, mm-hmm. because she seized all the land in Northern Ireland. So all of the land titles for all of the Protestants in Northern Ireland trace their origin back to Elizabeth. And if she's a fraud, the titles are a fraud. And it could reignite everything over there. Now, I didn't realize this when I wrote the book, but my British publisher, when I started writing the book, my British publisher, when I told him the idea, was very upset about this because Northern Ireland is a very sensitive subject in England.
Right.
And you don't want to do anything that it may incite anything. And I had to tone things down in this book in order to comply with that.
Oh, that's interesting. Uh-huh. It's very true, though. It is a very touchy subject still today. So, Why did Elizabeth, why do you think they, let me ask you this, first of all, do you think this really happened? I know there's a lot of evidence that you've talked about, but do you think, yes, it did happen?
Well, unfortunately, we don't know, and I would never know. Now, I think that it's a fascinating idea. It's a fascinating concept, simply from the fact that she absolutely refuses to marry and refuses to have a child. That was her number one duty. She saw what her father went through to get an heir, and then she's the last tutor, and she says, "Nope, sorry, we'll let the family can just die out right here, and I'm done."
Yeah, well, a lot of historians say, though, that she didn't want to get married because, or their theory is she didn't want to get married because she'd seen her father's marriages, and she just had very little faith in marriage, per se.
It's a one concept to look at, but it's not how people thought at that time. Mm-hmm. When you achieved the ultimate goal of your family becoming the ruling family of England, and her grandfather, you know, fought on the battlefield for that, and you've achieved that, you just don't throw it away. You don't. Yeah. Now, you might throw it away, though, if you can't have a child, and you might throw it away if you know you're an imposter, and you might throw it away because you hate the Tudors. The imposter himself, we know a good bit about him, he would have hated the Tudors with a passion. He was Henry's illegitimate grandson from Henry's firstborn child, who was illegitimate, and his mother was a Howard, and the Howards hated the Tudors with a passion. So that explains it. Another point, by the way, that makes this point is Elizabeth named James her successor, who was her cousin. And it came from a line of the family that in Henry VIII's will, he specifically said should never, ever, ever rule at all. He excluded them from all ruling. Yet, for some reason, Elizabeth ignored her father's wish and specifically gave the throne to them. Some say it's because he wasn't a Tudor. She was really a Howard, and he would do the exact opposite of Henry.
Right. And, of course, the theory is that Henry VIII never knew this.
No, he never knew he had a he knew about the marriage of his illegitimate son Henry to Mary Howard. He forbade them, though, from consummating the marriage. He had some superstitions about that. They ignored him and had a child anyway. That we do know. And the child was raised by the Howards in secret and basically disappeared from the face of the earth at around age 12.
Yeah. So another fact that you bring up in the book, you share in the story, and it's a contemporary story, as I said, is the Libyan terrorist who was convicted of bombing Pan Am Flight 103. We all know he was released on compassionate grounds, very controversial subject again. What I love about your books is that at the back of the book, you take the time to separate fact from fiction. You say where you've elaborated a little and you say what's actually fact. During the research, and I know you went to England twice to do this, was there something that really shocked you, something that surprised you?
Well, the whole Busy Boy legend shocked me.
Well, yeah, that's it.
You know, it did. And the fact that Elizabeth's tomb had never been opened. See, there's a way we could disprove this theory very quickly by opening the tomb and doing some DNA testing and comparative anatomy analysis. But that tomb has never been breached. It's one of the few royal tombs never opened. So we have no idea what's inside that tomb. Even during the English Civil War, they didn't go in and desecrate it like they did so many other tombs. So it surprised me that that tomb was sealed up. And, you know, everything about the legend was a little bit of a surprise to me. I had never heard anything like this before. And as I began to look into it more and more, I began to see that, you know, there's some basis to this. You know, don't forget those villagers for 300 years dressed a young boy up in female costume and paraded him around the street.
Right, right.
They did it for a reason. There's a reason why they did this. And so the whole concept fascinates me. And when you look at it with the context of Elizabeth and all her peculiarities, they all add up to one thing. She was hiding something. She was concealing something. And it could very well be that this fact. They have to understand, when they first did the impostering when she's little, no one ever thought anything would come of it. They just thought it would be a one-time thing, and that was it.
Yeah.
They were just doing it to keep Henry from killing them, because the child had died in their care, and Lady Ashley, her governess, was just trying to save herself. But once you start that, you can't quit. And they didn't quit. They kept on.
I love this story. And I have to tell you, Steve, when I first saw it, I was like, oh, that's rubbish, you know, because we grow up and we're told history. And, you know, the history we're told is only as good as the people who are telling it and, you know, willing to share. And the more I looked into it, and obviously I'm nowhere near to the extent that you have, it is definitely a fascinating subject.
It is a fascinating subject. And here's the thing. People will say, well, I've seen pictures of Elizabeth. I've seen paintings of her. No, you haven't. There's not a single painting of Elizabeth that exists that's real. She controlled her image after she became queen, and you painted Elizabeth exactly the way she told you to paint her, not the way you wanted to. We have no images of her prior to the age of 25. So we have no clue what this person looked like. Not a clue. And you got to get this Hollywood stuff out of your brain.
Yeah.
The Hollywood stereotyping's got to go out of your brain. None of that is real. That is all taken from the paintings of Elizabeth, which were contrived by her. It was called the Mask of Youth, and you were specifically told how to paint her, and you had no discretion in this.
Yeah. I would love to check back with you in a little while, see what kind of feedback you get from this. I know there are anti-royalists in Britain. I myself am a royalist, but, you know, this certainly would give them food for their cause.
It is, and there about 40 years ago, there was a group of radical lawyers in Ireland who began to look into the possibility that the land titles were actually void. And as I said, I never realized the sensitivity of the subject until my British publisher stepped in and said, you know, we can't just do this and say this. See, I would have written this book very differently for an American audience. I would have been right in your face with the Northern Ireland stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But over there, can't do it. So yeah. I had to tone it back a little bit because of the real fear that it could ignite something. I mean, the Northern Ireland's quiet, but it could reignite in 5 seconds.
Right, right. Well, the book, you know, the storyline, you've got assassins, traitors, spies, dangerous disciples of a secret society. Cotton Malone is up to his elbows in alligators, as they say.
He sure is.
And I want to thank you for being with us. I know you're touted as one of the hardest working authors. Travel 40 weeks of the year, I read. Where do you get time to write your books?
Well, we schedule it in and do it. I just got back from 3 weeks on the tour. I just got back yesterday. We were gone. We started in London and ended up after 3 weeks on the road.
All right. Well, thank you for being with us, Steve. And people can find out more about your work at steveberry.org, correct?
That's right. Right at the website. Everything's there.
All right. And Steve Berry's new book called The King's Deception. Fascinating stuff, I tell you. And you can find out more at steveberry.org. Please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by journalist Sally Ooms.
She's been married several times before, and everyone was an enemy. She wouldn't have a Willie or a Sam.
No, Sam.
I'm her eighth old man, I'm Henry. Henry the eighth I am. Second verse, same as the first. The eighth I am, Henry the eighth I am, I am.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Canine Caviar, we cover the world of animals. This week, June 30th, it's the last Sunday of the month, and that means it's a shelter, rescue, sanctuary, anything that helps our animal friends Sunday. We'll cover the birds with Mollywood Avian Sanctuary in Bellingham and the Macaw Sanctuary in Carnation. We'll cover the horses with All Breed Equine Rescue in Marysville and get a report on their first annual Community Awareness Day. Plus something new, Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Enjoy your food, but eat less. A simple way to eat less is to be mindful of what you're eating. This is registered dietitian Jim White. Eat slowly and enjoy the taste and texture of your food. Use hunger and fullness as cues to recognize when you've had enough. Healthy meals start with fruits, vegetables, and smaller portions of proteins and grains. And don't forget to choose low-fat or fat-free dairy. This is registered dietitian Jim White. Visit eatright.org for more healthy tips.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
The search is over. You found the station that's not afraid to be different. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
I'm Henry the 8th, I am.
All right, we are back with Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and Henry. Eric, of course, playing a little tribute there to Henry VIII, my former guest, based his story around his daughter. All right, well, next we're talking with Sally Ooms. She has been a print journalist for 30 years, and during that time she's been a reporter, correspondent, and editor for all kinds of publications in Oregon, California, New Mexico, Colorado, Missouri, Kansas. She's covered spot news, government, educational issues, and the arts, as well as mental health and other health issues. And she's written a new book. It's called Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. Sally Ooms, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Vicki. It's so great to join you.
Well, this is such an interesting book, and first of all, I love the artwork on the front. We were just talking about that. There's a picture of huge tree roots with a house blended into it. So tell us why you wanted to tell these stories, and just give us a synopsis of the book, if you would.
Sure, sure. And I just wanted to say one thing I saw on your website yesterday, and I think I heard it reiterated, ordinary people leading extraordinary lives, and that pretty much covers a lot of my book.
Right.
But anyway, yes, I'm a print journalist, and I've been focused on the issue of displacement for a number of years. But I started out the book about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, when there was so much displacement through natural disasters that it been in the news, and it seemed to me that it was getting more prevalent, and the storms and the whatever were getting more vicious. So I decided I wanted to interview people in this country who'd been displaced and talk to them about how they then created or recreated their homes. So I started out interviewing people who had been displaced by hurricanes or tornadoes, but then the theme of what home means and the issue of finding home again arose. So eventually I had about 10, I have 10 groupings of people who have similar struggles that they've overcome. And so the people who are included in the book, besides those who experienced the natural disasters, are former foster kids who I think we know so often get tossed from home to home and are divided from their siblings. And then I interviewed combat veterans returning from war who often feel ill at ease with that environment that they used to call home. And I interviewed older people moving to retirement homes or very often resisting moving to retirement homes. Then I talked with immigrants who are now citizens about their cultural shifts, their new homes, Navajo women who are fighting to retain the quality of their homeland.
Mm-hmm.
And then I included a formerly battered woman, another woman who talks about how her house is been foreclosed on several times, and a man in Santa Fe who tells us why he doesn't think we have to endure that anymore. And then I talk to homeless men and women, and I have a category at the end, a few people who I call finders, seekers, and they're people who are still kind of looking. They've found a home in various careers or professions, but now they're still, now they've retired or there's just been a shift, and they're looking for a different milieu.
Right, because
so of course that brings up the question of the definition of home.
Right, right. Because for many, you know, they would say, "Oh, home is the box they live in, the house,
yes,
the structure."
Yes.
For me, it's never really been that way. And how would you define it?
Well, I'll tell you what I discovered as I went along. Because, I mean, it was defined in so many ways and is. and it's different for all of us, and it's a combination of things lots of times. But and you're right, it's just rarely the building you inhabit. Although, I mean, that figures in largely for lots of people. And, I mean, we don't go telling people in Moore, Oklahoma right now who've been the victims of tornadoes, or people in Colorado Springs who've lost their houses to fires, that that isn't the strict definition of home.
Mm-hmm.
But after people go through this sort of mourning period or whatever, and then they discover, and then they start thinking about solutions for themselves. So I just discovered that it can mean so much more, but that it becomes apparent when you've lost your domicile. And so home, I think, is defined by the people we live with, our spouses, our partners, our family, close relationships, our friends. It can mean a community or a city or a region, but it also can mean things like a religion or a spiritual practice, as in the case of the Tibetan woman I interviewed.
Right.
And then some people just seem to carry home around in their heads, or simply in a place in their hearts. And it can mean simply feeling comfortable within your own skin, but I think the common thread is that it's a place bound up with our identity, and that's where we belong or we fit, but where we have the opportunity to be our authentic self, don't you?
Yes, I would say that. There's just a feeling. I remember when I was looking to move from California, and I traveled all up and down the East Coast and all up and down the West Coast. And when I got to Seattle, I was like, okay, I can live here.
Isn't that
amazing? It's a feeling. Yeah. You can't describe it to anyone.
No, you can't. You can't. And I feel lucky because I've moved lots of times, but most of the times it's been elective.
Yeah. 22 times I've heard you've moved.
Yeah, well, actually, I think I counted again, and it's 23.
23 times. So are you one of those at the end of the book that's still seeking, or has your work taken
you?
No,
I mean, I know what makes the home feel right to me. I mean, I've moved because of a new job, a spouse's new job. At one point, I moved back to my hometown of Kansas City to take care of my elderly mother. But I've never had the devastating things that some of my interviewees have had.
Mm-hmm.
But I think feeling at home has more to do for me with the person I live with, or when I have been by myself, how comfortable I feel with my life in general. And then I love living near friends. I just read something, a quote from William Blake, and he says, "The bird a nest, the spider a web, man friendship." And I really believe that, and it's a large part of my home feeling. Includes a community of friends.
Right. Well, there's a saying in England, I don't know if they use it here, but a saying in England, home is where you hang your hat. And that's kind of how I've always felt. If I've got into my, wherever I'm living and made my little nest, it doesn't matter. I can be camping and make a nest of my tent, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Well, and then there's homes where the heart is, right?
Yes.
You have that as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, there's one woman in the book I'm leafing through right now, who talks about she was a former foster child, and she had now she is always trying to make it's very important for the former foster children. I find family is a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
So she adopted her 13-year-old sister. And when she could, and then at the time I interviewed her, she was taking care of her 98-year-old grandfather, and he was on hospice, and he was taking up the only room in the bedroom in the house. And oh, I mean, you know, it was just this woman, and she was saying, "Oh, I don't know if I'm doing things well enough." She was working, she was going to school. I mean, for heaven's sakes. But she says, "I've been trying to find or make a home lots of times, but I found it has to happen inside me. The only thing I can do is control me. I'm a spiritual person. I rely on a higher power, but I find that home is within myself."
Mm.
And that really moved me.
There were a lot of profound stories, a lot of things that just made you stop and think. And of course, you know what shocked me, since we're talking about the foster, somebody who was a foster child, is that they're toughed out at the age of 18 and basically left to their own resources.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, unfortunately, and I don't know the statistics, but they told me that there are just tons of former foster kids who are on the street, who are homeless now, and a lot in prison. And so that says something to the system. Not working.
Right. Now, the book is, you know, you do focus on how these people triumph. There are 48 people profiled in the book. The stories are told in the first person.
Yes, which makes them more immediate, I think.
It does, and it gives you their own voice. And so you said what surprised you was listening to the people you talked with was the things they had in common, even though they were very different kinds of people. So tell us what that thing in common was.
Well, I mean, it was different things in common, and I think as people read these stories, they're going to find that I basically put it together. I mean, I don't want to say that I haven't been dismissive as well, but lots of times people are dismissive of others or groups of people, and it's just that we're so stressed and strained. I mean, we just don't have time to even think about how we could help somebody else. And you know, I didn't want to write a book that made people feel guilty. And so I just wanted people to sort of see more than there, but for the grace of God go I. Just say, gee, I didn't think I had anything in common with this particular person, but look how he or she handled this situation. That's great, that's interesting, that's something I might employ towards my own problem, and bring people closer. I just think there's this greater and greater connectivity between among people right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's great power in that, and it particularly comes out when there are times of hardship.
Right. Yeah. And perseverance. My mother always used to din this, and my father. Perseverance is probably one of the best traits you can have. And you say that they all had this characteristic within them.
Yes, absolutely. And then I like the word in the subtitle, prevailing, because they are prevailing.
Yes. So of all of the people you spoke with, has one kind of haunted you? Because I know when you do this kind of story, it can get emotional.
Yes, that's true. I really love all the people in this book, so it's really hard to choose. And then I have days where I think about one of them or another one of them.
Right.
I really admire, and I've heard from other people who've read it, a woman named Louise Yellowman. She was a Navajo woman who herded sheep in the remote mountains of New Mexico for the first 12 years of her life. And she could still be there sheep herding, but anyway, she had an aunt who would come and visit her grandparents. She was with her grandparents. And she was a nurse, and she was kind of a role model for Louise. And she told her, you've got to get your education. And so she found a way to get her education, although it was a fight every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
People said, well, why don't you just marry a nice Navajo man and have Navajo children? And she did that. But she and her husband moved to this destitute portion of the Navajo Nation called the Bennett Frees, and she became a teacher, and she started a school, and she became active in her chapter house, and she ended up running for county supervisor, and she served in this capacity for 30 years.
Wow,
from all sorts of things done for her this neglected area of the Navajo Nation. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, we're right at the end of our show, Sally, and I want to let listeners know that you are going to be up here. Is it tomorrow?
Well, I'm going to go jump on a plane in just a minute. So I will be there, yes. And I'm going to be speaking at Park Place Books in Kirkland tomorrow night, and then Third Place Books in Lake Forest Park on Thursday night, June 27th.
Okay. And is that information up on your website?
Yes, and if you want to go somewhere else and purchase the book, of course, you can just have the bookstore order it if they don't have it. It's available on Amazon and ebook form, or you can go to the website.
And your website is?
FindingHomeStories.com.
FindingHomeStories.com, and journalist Sally Ooms wrote this book, and really interesting, heartwarming stories in there. Sally Ooms, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And I want to thank each of you for listening in today. Glad we got through this show. I was like rushed. I thought for the first time in 9 years I was going to be late today because of traffic. It took 2 hours to get here. So I'm glad we got through the show. And we will be back next week. You can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or info@conversationslive.net. And you can find our website at conversationslive.net. Of course, you can also follow us on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Thanks for being with us. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.